Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us for this post-argument episode of SCOTUScast. I'm your host, Spencer Caron. The Supreme Court heard oral arguments for Google LLC versus Oracle America Inc. on October 7, 2020. Two questions were before the court. The first was whether copyright protection extends to a software interface, and second was whether, as a jury found, Google's use of a software interface in the context of creating a new computer program constitutes fair use. Google reused roughly 11,000 lines of declaring code written by Oracle, but rewrote or purchased all other codes that provided Android's functionality. Oral arguments address whether the 11,000 lines of declaring code are protected by copyright, and if so, whether Google's use of them was fair. Michael Risch joins us to discuss this case's oral arguments. Risch is Vice Dean and Professor of Law at Villanova University's Charles Widger School of Law and author of an amicus brief in support of Google.
Thank you for having me, and thanks to the Federal Society for hosting. I will say that I have learned not to guess how cases are going to come out after oral argument. This case is no different. I suppose I was not surprised by Justice Breyer's long questions because I've heard him ask very similar long questions, or at least read them in transcripts many times. And so it's a pretty common practice, although he did ask very long questions of each side, although they had similar substance. But what was really interesting about the oral argument is that you could instantly tell the weak side of each party by the questioning. And usually it's one issue it's one issue at issue. And so the weak side are, you know, the little minor parts of it. But here it was like two questions presented, and there were literally questions about the first question to one party and the second question to the other party. So what do I mean by that? Google got most questions relating to copyrightability. What do you mean? What about merger? Aren't you just stealing from the goodwill from Oracle, et cetera? When does merger get counted? Is it the time of creation? Is it the time of reuse, et cetera? Oracle, on the other hand, most of the questions were about fair use. What about the standard review? Why shouldn't the jury's verdict stand, et cetera, et cetera? And so that really frames where the issues are. And the interesting thing is either one of those questions could resolve this. And so what's funny is you could theoretically see a reversal here with a fractured opinion. You could split 4-4 and have Google win unanimously. You could have a 4-4 split that it's copyrightable. You could have a 4-4 split that there should be fair use. And what you wind up with then is an 8-0 split that the fair use is there. Now, I don't think that's how it's going to break, but it's a possibility. Moving a little bit, that was the 10,000 foot view. So moving down a little bit, I think really what was happening throughout all of the questions is that the court and also the advocates are struggling with the key question, which is, what are we going to do about APIs? Now, you'd think they wouldn't be struggling with that because that's the key question in the case. But We are, because it seems like nobody can get their arms around what's really at stake here. We saw nibbling at it at the edges, you know, referring to the amicus briefs of the computer scientists who say that APIs are used, et cetera. But nobody just blatantly asked the key question, which is, are we going to allow people to write compatible compilers or not? If somebody makes the C language, are we going to allow other people to make the C compilers, or does the person who writes the C language get to own the C language forever? Is the person who writes Fortran get to own Fortran for practically forever because they're the only one who can write a compiler? That's the question that's at stake here. And nobody seemed to say that clearly, because that is a really important question. And the other thing that didn't come out on that question is that everybody is already reusing compilers. Oracle is coming out, APIs. Oracle is making a compatible API so that it looks like it is Amazon Web Services, because it wants to compete and it wants to take advantage of the fact that people have already written code that works with Amazon Web Services. To me, the hubris of Oracle pushing this case while also advertising that it's written APIs that are the same as Amazon's Web Services is amazing, because this is how competitive functioning works. Getting down to a little bit more detail and the struggling with this key question, one thing that was interesting to me is that the analogy in Google's brief about this being like a file cabinet got no traction at all. Nobody mentioned it. Nobody used it as a way to talk about things. The Chief Justice came out with a question that said, what about all the headings of a brief? And I felt like there wasn't a good answer to that question, or, you know, that it was almost like it wasn't ready for that question. And then later we got to the QWERTY keyboard and we got to the grocery store, and, you know, theoretically those aren't copyrightable, but of course they are with the grocery store. If you do a menu, a map of where your groceries are, well, then that would be copyrightable. To me, that was a really good analogy, because if you have a catalog of where your groceries are and it's copyrighted because you had creative structure, sequence, and organization, does that mean that nobody else can organize their groceries in the same way, because it would necessitate making a catalog that looks the same? That is getting at the point, but that was like just a minor little question right at the very end. There was no traction for any of these analogies, and I think that really made the arguments suffer a little bit. The next point I'll talk about is that finally they got to my key issue. So I wrote, and so it's this is really what about my needs. I wrote an amicus brief in favor of Google, and it took a slightly different tack. It said, look, and it was ironically targeted at Justice Ginsburg, who sadly was not there on the court to rule on it. But the idea is that, yes, of course, this is copyrightable. Justice Gorsuch wound up asking that question. Can we get past the point of saying that the code is not copyrightable and instead talk about filtration, which Justices Kagan and Sotomayor wound up talking about eventually? That is my take in the brief, that the problem in this case is really the procedural posture, that the jury found infringement because there was never given an option to do filtration, that if they had done the type of filtration you ordinarily do, this would be not an unusual case. None of the parties really cited Bateman versus Mnemonics, which is an API abstraction filtration comparison case, which was completely non-controversial in its day. This case could have been just like that. And then finally, I'll end with a point that came up over and over and over again. I don't know if we'll get an answer to it in this case, but in the weeds of copyright doctrine, this question of when do you consider merger? Do you consider it at the time of creation or at the time of reuse? I'm not sure we'll get a good answer to that. The reason I wrote my brief is I tend to disagree with Google on this. I think the question of merger is generally at the time you create, but I don't think it matters because if you're doing filtration properly, you are filtering out those things that you need to make the functional aspects of the work work. And one thing that did not get mentioned at all here, also in the doctrinal weeds of copyright, and I'll end on this, is that Baker versus Selden doesn't just say we separate idea and expression. It also says that when we are talking about reusing something that's functional, we allow it even if some expression might go along with it. And so all of this argument about the fact that there was expression and Oracle could have done this a different way, to me, is mostly irrelevant. One way or another, if you are going to have a compatible compiler, and that's the big policy question, then some expression is going to have to go along with it. And so we don't have to argue about whether it's copyrightable. We don't have to argue about whether it was creative. We don't have to argue about whether it's structure, sequence, and organization. The only thing we have to ask is, are these the types of things that you use in order to make a compatible compiler or interpreter work? And the answer is yes, and that's the end of it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.